adverse outcomes related to novel agents.
Is there value to making study data available to all investigators?
Can we control gout with a diet?
And finding cancer-associated mutations in benign tissue.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on May 12, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'm going to reveal to our listeners that we had a robust discussion before we started to record on one of the studies that I chose this week. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was on the identification of mutations that are typically associated with cancer in things that are not cancerous. And you pushed back, but then ultimately said, okay, we'll do it.
Normally, we don't talk about studies beforehand. In fact, we didn't talk about the specifics of this particular study. So let me tell our listeners, this is a little heavy in science, but I think the implications are pretty profound. These investigators look at a condition called endometriosis. It's a relatively common disease. It affects about 10% of women in childbearing age and about 50% of adolescents that have pelvic pain. It's a condition where endometrial tissue, which is normally in the uterus, is outside the uterus. It could be in the fallopian tubes or the ovaries, or could be in the abdominal cavity called the peritoneum. It's a benign condition, and very rarely does it ever become malignant in less than 1% of individuals. And usually if it's the ovarian-associated type of endometriosis. But here's what these investigators did that was novel. They took 24 different patients and looked at the endometrial tissue doing what's called exome-wide sequencing and cancer driver-targeted sequencing, genetic analysis of the tissue. They found in 80% of the patients, there were actually mutations, and importantly, in about a fourth of the time, those mutations were normally mutations associated with cancer, yet they're in a benign tissue. You and I both have talked about the fact that we're oftentimes sampling blood or tissue, looking to see what is the risk that that tissue or that blood sample reveals indolent cancer. This suggests that in a benign condition, there are cancer-associated mutations and cancer just doesn't develop. It brings into question the credibility or the reliability of those tests. And secondly, there must be other factors besides just a single mutation. Maybe it takes multiple mutations or what's called epigenetic changes outside the gene, but just a single identification of a cancer-associated mutation doesn't mean the patient is going to develop cancer.
And the implications of this, of course, are profound because we are genotyping more and more people, and not just people who have frank cancer, but people we think may be at risk for cancer or who have a profound family history of cancer or a premalignant lesion. And I think it suggests that we don't really understand fully the role of these mutations with regard to the causation of cancer.
And there are a lot of genetic tests being promulgated right now determining what your cancer risk is. As you suggest, this tells us the identification of a single mutation doesn't give us that information alone. We still have a lot of work to do.
And I think we need to really emphasize that for patients, because I can certainly envision a scenario where someone would be told that they have an aberrant condition. It may be benign, but it still isn't normal, where there's the presence of a mutation typically associated with cancer, and that could cause a lot of mental anxiety.
And it could even lead to wrong therapy. And in instances where insurance companies are involved, they could actually increase your rates if they think that you have an increased risk of developing cancer. So a lot of implications. So I'm glad you chose this study, importantly for the science, but also for the implications as well.
Well, I thank you for your graciousness and agreeing to talk about it. Since we're in NEJM, then let's stay there. Something that also has really broad societal implications, I think, use of data that has been revealed in the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute database.
And I'm going to call it the NHLBI, abbreviated. This agency instituted a formal data repository in 2000, and that was to facilitate the sharing of data from clinical trials and observational studies with the general scientific community. The investigators that received funding from the NHLBI had to agree to put their data de-identified, but the data had to go into a repository that 2 years after the study was completed that could be made available to the scientific community at large. What this particular group of authors did So he said, listen, this has been going on for 16 years now. Let's look at the number of times an investigator, other than the original group, requested the data, and what did they do with that information, and how was it used? So from 2000 to 2016, there have been a total of 370 investigators that have requested data from one or more of the clinical trials. What has it been used for? Well, about three-fourths of the time, it was used to do a secondary analysis to ask new questions, not to do redundant studies or repeat the study. And about 15% of the time, it was used to either do some new analytic or statistical approach, or to do some meta-analysis where they could pool the study resource. And in only two of the 370 investigator-requested data was it actually initiated to do reanalysis of the primary outcome findings. There were a total of 277 articles published as a result of this. And by the way, these publications rank in the top third of what are considered the most important studies for that particular year. So it looks like the sharing of data has been a really useful thing.
I'm a big fan of this, and I would frankly like to see the practice expanded, and in fact, in lots of places it has been. For example, NIH-funded grants, the data has to be publicly available. I think all of this goes toward the idea, the promise of the electronic health record, of being able to discern big trends and things, and also reducing the number of times a study might be seeking the same data.
Can we go back? Has somebody done a similar study? And can I look at a subset or an analysis? Can I just look at the data to generate a hypothesis or an answer to that? And I think that's really important. And I think this is the way that the pharmaceutical companies should act, by the way. They should make their data available.
From here, let's turn to the British Medical Journal. I framed it up as, can we control gout with diet?
Gout is the most common inflammatory arthritis and affects about 3 or 4% of the population, and is caused by having an increased amount of uric acid. We know that there are certain food products that contribute to that, those food products that are high in protein, like red meats, for example. When individuals have high uric acid or gout, it's been recommended they eat what's called a purine-free diet. That is a low-protein diet. But oftentimes, they'll substitute carbohydrates for the protein, which increases the risk of insulin resistance and diabetes, which, by the way, increases your risk of having an increased uric acid. Can we identify a diet that's acceptable that can have the same effect? We know that the DASH diet, promulgated by the American Heart Association, it's based on a high intake of fruits and vegetables, nuts, legumes, low-fat dairy products, and whole grains, a low intake of sodium, sweetened beverages, and red and processed meats, is associated with lowering blood pressure, lowering the risk of stroke, lowering the risk of kidney stones, and parenthetically, it happened to lower blood uric acid. These investigators looked at 44,000 men that had never had gout. They ascertained, did they eat a DASH diet or a Western diet, and did that affect their risk of having gout? And what they discovered is the men that ingested a DASH diet, it lowered their risk of having gout by about 32%. Conversely, the men that ingested a Western diet, it increased their risk of gout by 42%.
I'm wondering if it's possible to motivate men to stick to such a diet and reduce their risk of gout by measuring uric acid levels periodically so they can say, hey, it looks like it's really working.
I think that's great advice, Elizabeth. There are many men that don't want to take a medication, and they certainly don't want to have gout. It's really a terribly debilitating arthritis, very painful. And so if you could manage that with a diet and you know you have a high uric acid, that can be a motivating factor.
Right, and all these other benefits too, reducing one's risk of cardiovascular outcomes and diabetes, these are all good things.
It is.
Now, let us turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, taking a look at adverse outcomes of novel agents approved by the FDA.
I have served on several FDA panels. Unfortunately, the data that we have is usually data from studies conducted in individuals that number 100 or maybe 1,000. And the studies are usually short-term, 6 months or 12 months. Well, that doesn't give us information about risks that are relatively uncommon or that may be manifest years later. So the tension is, do we wait and do the study in tens or 20 or 30,000 patients and wait for 5 years? Or do we approve them relatively short and small number of individuals and not know the side effects? So that's the balance. To address that, what the FDA has done is they do post-marketing analysis of safety. So the FDA has data now that goes back over 15 years. So the investigators looked at agents that have been approved from 2001 to 2010, and they asked the question, How often does the FDA go back and either withdraw it or express concern about safety? Over that 10-year period, there were 222 novel therapeutics approved, some of them pharmaceutical, some biologics. About a third of these were associated with safety events after they had been marketed. There were biologics, psychiatric drugs, and also drugs that were receiving accelerated approval.
The last category, of course, really concerns me because, as we're both aware, there's a lot of legislation out there, this right to try legislation. And I'm wondering if that problem is going to be exacerbated if we truncate the amount of time it takes for a new agent to get to the market.
If you either decrease the number of patients in which the study is conducted or you shorten the time period, you're clearly going to miss some of the safety issues. What this study makes clear to me is that we need to continually monitor the safety of novel therapeutics throughout their entire life cycle.
Okay, on that note, I'm going to talk about the endometriosis study in NEJM this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.